You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 26th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Does brandishing the G word at Israel actually help with anything? Should other countries submit to an American justice system which may still impose the ultimate penalty? And have we possibly learned a lesson about the folly of engaging opinion-honking bloviators as political pundits? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Tessa Shishkovitz and Sir William Patey, will discuss the day's big stories. And we'll hear from the author Michael Kimmage about his new book, Collisions, analysing the historical forces behind Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Tessa Shishkovitz, UK correspondent for the Austrian weekly magazine Falter and author of Echte Engländer, Britain and Brexit, and by Sir William Patey, former British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and currently a political consultant. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Good evening.
Tessa, you recently have returned from Japan. Please try to stay awake for the next 40 minutes at least.
Well, if you hear a sort of light snoring, it's me on this program.
Why did you go to Japan?
For a vacation. And we were looking for the cherry blossom for about 10 days, equipped with blossometers, sort of, you know, these websites that tell you where the cherry blossom will be blooming today. And unfortunately, it never really happened.
See, Tessa, I have cherry blossoms in my back garden.
You
would have needed go no further than Leytonstone.
Off to Regent's Park, I say. Forget Japan. No, but it was lovely in Japan. You know, the cherry blossom was just one little reason to explore a new country for me.
William, listeners recently shared your tale of woe of a cruise on which you were going to be speaking being called off because of the Houthis taking pot shots at passing shipping. But you may have another opportunity, as I understand it, to go to sea and share your wisdom at the same time.
Well, I'm putting my luck to the test, but I'm going to from San Francisco to New York via the Panama Canal. And the only risk to this cruise is that the Panama Canal may be dry and they have to shut it. So if they do shut it, I'm going to have to book one on under an assumed name and accept that I'm just jinxed.
Is this really a thing, the Panama Canal running dry? Because that sounds like a fairly fundamental problem for a shipping channel.
Yes, well, apparently it is reliant on a big lake when it moves ships up and down, uses water from a big lake. And apparently that big lake is not as big as it should be. So there is an issue.
Well, we will keep our fingers crossed for you and indeed for Panama. But we will start tonight's show properly with Israel. And pretty much since Israel launched its retaliation for the Hamas attacks of last October 7th, Israel's critics have been keen to accuse Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. The chorus will shortly be swelled by a report from Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Territories. Albanese suggests that Israel has violated three of the five acts listed under the UN Genocide Convention. Israel and its defenders are entitled to observe that Albanese owes her appointment to the UN Human Rights Council, whose current members include China, Eritrea, Sudan, and Somalia, among others, whose record on the human rights front is arguably somewhat rickety, and that Albanese herself has a lengthy history of making dubious remarks about Israel. William, first of all, how seriously should anybody take this?
Well, it's not for Francesca Albanese to opine or to come to a judgment on whether Israel is committing genocide or not. There's a case before the International Court of Justice brought by the South Africans. Mm. There's a legal convention. The South Africans have put forward what a lot of people would regard as a reasonable case, mm-hmm. and it will be adjudicated in a court of law. I mean, the convention is pretty clear about the acts that would constitute genocide, the deliberate killing and harm of a particular race or group of people. There's a case to answer. Mm-hmm. It's not for me to decide whether it's genocide or not, and I don't think it actually is for Albanese. But the problem is that Israel, because Jews were the victim of the biggest genocide, the unarguable genocide earlier in the 20th century, the Israeli government takes the view that they're immune to criticism, and they've accused Albanese of being anti-Semitic and...
Well, on the subject of cases to answer, though, if you go through some of Albanese's past outbursts, it's not like the Israelis don't have material to work with.
Well, criticising the Israeli government doesn't make you an anti-Semite, and that's the problem. The Israeli government tries to create a situation which, if you're critical of their actions, you're labelled an anti-Semite. Indeed, she's been accused of denying Israel the right to exist, which, you know, in my view, I mean, Israel is a state, it's a legitimate state, and it has a right to exist. So I think that the problem is that somehow Israel is judged by different standards on issues like war crimes, and I think they're given a freer pass than some other countries.
Well, ironically, Israel makes that exact case in its own defence, Tessa, that it is judged by different standards. And we have seen, for example, just today in London, campaigners from Amnesty International putting up a street sign outside the Israeli embassy, renaming the street on which it sits as Genocide Avenue. I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I don't recall Amnesty International doing that to the embassies of, for example, Syria, Russia or China.
Yeah, I think there's a case that we all have to somehow deal with, that our relationship to Israel, if we are, for example, Germans and Austrians, we have also a different relationship to Israel than maybe other nations. Mm. So in the case of the, you know, if the media, for example, now calls what Israel is doing in Gaza a genocide, we usually don't do that in the Austrian and German press, because we feel that the genocide that was committed by our nations against the Jews has a singular meaning in world history till today, even if other atrocities like the war that is now going on in Gaza is absolutely devastating. So I wonder if maybe the Austrian-German position on this is a bit old-fashioned in a way, because maybe genocide should be going, the term and the use of it should be undergoing a shift to include also, I don't want to say lesser genocides or lesser murders of populations, but in a sense that the singularity of the Holocaust is not the most important thing in this debate, but the victims and their suffering is. And if you ask Palestinians today, of course, anything that can help them, they would like to be applied to helping them. And the idea that South Africa brought this genocide case in front of the ICC in The Hague was to help the Palestinians. And in that sense, I think it's a very, very tricky, complicated thing. I think that a lot of Israelis also feel that they are being attacked in a disrespectful way in a historical perspective. But the problem is that also the Israeli government has shifted politics to a very, very extreme side of what you can do in a conflict. And the war crimes that are being committed now, and cutting off electricity and water to a whole population that cannot defend itself, in that sense, it's a very, very problematic thing to do. So if we call it genocide or not, it's wrong.
But William, does it actually advance, anybody, anywhere, that the genocide term does keep getting bandied about in this conflict as it does in no other? As you were, you know, suggesting and pointing out earlier, genocide is actually quite a tightly defined legal term. There are criteria which need to be applied. And as you mentioned, there is a case underway. But it has become, has it not, a phrase signifying any deaths of civilians in a war which I, the interlocutor, happen to personally not approve?
Oh, it's bandied about far too freely. And indeed, it's quite difficult to prove genocide. You have to prove intent. And the intent issue, I mean, there are some Israeli commentators, there are some ministers in the Israeli government who, by their very statements about wanting to drive Palestinians out of Gaza, are indicating intent, but that's not the official policy of the Israeli government. And I often think it's a diversion. It allows you get into a debate about genocide, as I said, there are war crimes being committed. I don't think anyone's doubting that. The killing of the civilians and the destruction of schools and universities and hospitals. These are war crimes, whether you call them genocide or not, and they may well be adjudicated. When I was in Sudan, we had this big argument in Darfur. Was it genocide? And I said, well, why should we get diverted? What's happening is an atrocity. Are we legally obliged to do something different if it's called genocide or if it's not?
By some readings of the Genocide Convention, you are obliged.
Well,
that's why the United States has tiptoed around a few things in the past with phrases like acts of genocide.
The legal advice I had at the time was there's nothing more we have to do if it's called genocide. The perpetrators would be held to account. But in international law, there's nothing that we as a state or a member of the Security Council. So I said, well, let's not argue about whether it's genocide or not. Let's try and stop it. Let's try and stop what's happening, because whatever it is called, it's unacceptable and it needs to come to an end.
Tessa, just finally on this from you, I wanted to go back to what you were saying about Germany and Austria and how they have traditionally, for obvious historical reasons, trodden a bit more carefully around Israel. Do you get a sense that that is changing at all in the last 6 months or so?
Well, I wonder if the pressure from the street, for example, changes something. And you have at pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the word genocide is being chanted usually in English. You know, these slogans, even in Berlin, are chanted in English. So genocide or from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free. All these slogans that many Israelis find offensive are often used in English.
But you could make the reasonable case as well that Hamas's own charter is an explicit call to genocide in that it calls for the elimination of the Israeli state. And if on October 7th Hamas could have killed even more people than they did, I rather suspect they would have.
Yes, and I think we should not leave it to Hamas also to decide these questions for us all. Yeah, because of course they are an extremist organization that commits these terror acts, happily so. And so that makes that doesn't make the things easier. Yeah, so you have on both sides, you have leaderships, you have groups that are sort of involved in genocidal acts. And you do have, and that's also interesting, it's the definition that Anshel Pfeffer in Haaretz used a few months ago, was that you do have this messianic wing in the Israeli government, these ministers who are probably, we could probably call genocidaires, like in the case in Rwanda in 1994 when the Hutus were sort of slaughtering Tutsis. They were genocidaires too. They were sort of murdering. They had an intent to actually murder people. Populations, right? Sort of included in the genocide definition is expulsion, ethnic cleansing. These are the things that are in the minds of some parts of the Israeli government. And so we have to somehow include the discussion about this, even if we don't, in my opinion, I don't think that in Germany and in Austria, people will easily accuse Israel or use these words easily in our reporting also in the near future.
Well, here in the UK, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has won at least a temporary delay to the ongoing efforts by the United States to extradite him to face espionage charges pertaining to the release, circa 2010, of hundreds of thousands of classified American documents, by some estimations nearly as many as Donald Trump stashed in the guest bathrooms at Mar-a-Lago. The UK's High Court has said it will not rule on extradition unless the US furnishes assurances that Assange, an Australian citizen, long resident in the UK, will not be threatened by the death penalty. The US now has 3 weeks to comply. William, first of all, is this a meaningful likelihood, do you think, or is this a legal ploy by Assange's team? I looked this up earlier. I think I'm right about this. The last executions under the US Espionage Act were Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in 1953.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Americans won't have any difficulty giving an assurance that he wouldn't be subject to the death penalty. And that's what the courts... This is not the first time the courts have insisted on that, that we're not prepared to extradite someone to a country where the death penalty could be a consequence. So I expect the Americans will give that assurance if they can. And my own view on this is, you know, Assange has been in jail long enough for whatever... The crimes he's committed, he's had a life sentence, 7 years in the... you know, the El Salvador, the Ecuadorian embassy, and 5 years in Belmarsh. But I'm afraid, you know, the Americans are intent on getting them there, and I would expect them to give the assurances that the High Court are asking for.
I mean, is there an amount generally of grandstanding going on here, Tessa, from Assange's team, aside from the worries they've expressed about the death penalty? They're also suggesting that he might be on the hook for a prison term of 175 years, whereas the US government's line has been that if he is convicted, somewhere in the vicinity of 4 to 6 is more likely. I'm not saying 4 to 6 years in a federal penitentiary would be an easy stretch, but...
Well, if you look at the charges, he's not charged for anything now that carries the death penalty.
Mm.
So, but what the legal team fears is that that might change. Let's say he gets extradited. We have a different president and in the near future. And, you know, people play around with new charges against Assange, just to set an example. So the question, if he faces a fair trial or if these charges can change, is, I think, not completely absurd, especially not if you're the wife of the man who is facing these charges or these trials, this court case. On the other hand, I think you have a point in saying that this constant repetition to say, like, he faces, like, he could get 135 years. Well, probably not. And the Washington Post reported in February that there's this plea bargain deal being at least considered. So again, the legal team of Assange says that they have not been presented with any of this, even through back channels or anything like it. So we don't know what will happen. But today in front of the court, when I was standing there, I was thinking there's a real sense of, you know, all the media like me came to hear what's going on. Not a lot of supporters were there, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and a few others who think that the CIA wants to murder Assange anytime soon and is worse than the FSB and all sorts of things. So I have the feeling that people get a little bit tired over all these years now and think, like you, that he has served already 5 years in a high security prison in the UK without even being without a verdict on his crimes. So there's something is really wrong in this whole thing, and they should find a solution to release him, maybe via extradite him to Australia and then sort of not look as closely anymore what happens with him.
I mean, to offset the more lurid claims of what he would get, I mean, Chelsea Manning got 7 years and she's now out, and she was the...
Well, she got 35
years. Yeah, but she's out after
and
seven.
And Obama pardoned her after seven.
Out after seven. So, I mean, she was the one who actually, you know, stole the information, if you like. I suppose the claim against the espionage claim against Assange is that he commissioned, and he commissioned Chelsea Manning to steal this, as opposed to was just a journalist receiving information. Mm. I mean, I suppose that's what his case would hinge on. But you know, I suspect
that's dancing on the head of a pin somewhat.
No, indeed.
But to go back to the original dumps by WikiLeaks, 2010, 2011, in diplomatic circles, were they regarded as monstrously disruptive, or as I think is often the case with leaks of allegedly classified material, they tend to either confirm what we already knew or what we could probably have guessed?
Well, they were embarrassing, and they exposed some practices in Iraq that, you know, I suppose the American military would rather weren't exposed. So they were quite embarrassing, but I don't think they were strategic harm to the American cause. Or I mean, there were many claims at the time, as they made with Edward Snowden, that people's lives were put at risk. But I've not seen any information that says that anyone has died as a result of these leaks. So it's very difficult to get to the truth of how serious they were. I suspect one side has an interest in exaggerating it, and another side has an interest in playing it down.
Well, to this week's demonstration of the eternal truth that there is nothing in this world, no war nor disaster nor crisis, that the media enjoys reporting on quite as much as reporting on itself. The present flap has been occasioned by the decision of the American network NBC to engage as a pundit Ronna McDaniel, former chair chair of the Republican National Committee, and more pertinently to the current Garment Rending, a serial propagator of the absurd fantasy that the 2020 presidential election was actually won by Donald Trump, which, to be clear, it wasn't. Several of McDaniel's putative future colleagues have been up in arms, while McDaniel herself has attempted to walk back certain of her previous Trumpist orthodoxy. There's some breaking news on this in the last hour or so, Tessa, which is that apparently the deal is off. One would probably need the proverbial heart of stone not to laugh out loud at this point. But honestly, is it clear to you what NBC thought they were doing or how they imagine this could possibly end other than how it appears to have just ended?
Well, as far as I understand, A, she was not supposed to be actually a political commentator seen on screen, but sort of giving analysis or something, background. Then they often do hire people who had, political affiliations, and they do that in a lot of channels, all sorts all over the world. And the more right-wing it gets, the more outrageous they become. That's how it is.
But the question that then obtains, William, is where you draw a line. There is obviously nothing wrong with hiring conservative analysts, pundits and commentators. I think over the last little while of the Republican Party having its ongoing nervous breakdown, we here at Monocle Radio have been quite punctilious about putting American conservative voices on the air, but they tend to be serious and sensible ones, not the sort of swivel-eyed headbanger tendency that Ronald McDaniel represents. Should you draw a line, though, between somebody who is a conservative of conservative outlook, even Trumpist outlook, versus somebody who attempted to propagate an obvious fantasy that the previous presidential election was fixed?
I mean, for a broadcaster like NBC, which is probably slightly more liberal than some of the other ones, it seems strange that they were trying to correct some balance. I know The Guardian from time to time has the odd right wing commentator just on, but I don't think somebody like that should be banned from having a say in the media. I mean, if you look at what's happening in this country, we've got a news channel, GB News, which mm-hmm. has sitting conservative politicians interviewing their colleagues.
Or in one celebrated case, their sister.
Their sister or their colleague, purporting to be a legitimate news organisation, and Ofcom is still looking at it. So, I'm pretty sure that the NBC case doesn't go anywhere near what we're seeing in the UK with GB News.
But have we learnt nothing, Tessa, and to ask the question is to answer it, I suspect, about reporting politics as if it's some sort of Punch and Judy show? The NBC is doing that thing that a lot of the mainstream media does feel obliged to do, as in we're joined now by somebody who believes that the earth is round, so we feel obliged to put somebody on the same chat who thinks it's flat.
Well, I've always believed that this is part of the reason why this country got
I thought you were about to say you'd always believed that the earth was flat, which would
yes,
have taken
which things... Which I also, today, in the jet lag from coming from Japan, I might actually be excused for thinking that. But I think you're totally right. We have to be very careful who is being put on air, especially, in unedited ways. Mm-hmm. When you write, when you think about the story, you can sort of balance voices out. If you put one-to-one people who have outrageous political opinions and constant and are fringe, and if you promote them long enough, they might become a mainstream, like it happened at Brexit. And that was because Nigel Farage was put against, constantly on, and then, it seemed as if that was a normal voice, which was at the beginning certainly not the case. And so I think it's very, very important to think who gets a voice. I don't think people should be banned easily either, but it's a question of balance also. Yeah,
I mean, it comes back, I think, William, to that thing of trying to package politics as entertainment, and I kind of feel for the networks in that respect because they have so much more to compete against than they used to. They want to keep people's eyes on their screens. They know that outrage and controversy does generate that. I mean, Donald Trump was massive box office for the networks through both of his presidential runs, and it will doubtless be the same for his third. But where do you think responsibility lies? Is it the broadcasters who just go, OK, if it's what the people want, let's give it to them? Or is it the fault of the people for wanting it in the first place?
Well, the broadcaster's role is to seek the truth, I think. That's a journalistic role, is to seek the truth.
But is anybody going to watch that?
Well, they will, because you can put Donald Trump on and the broadcaster's duty is to call him out for his lies, you know, or even Rona. You know, they go on, they make these claims. It's the broadcaster's job to come up with a whole set of facts and say there is no evidence for that. How come you... you know?
But they have a base that doesn't care.
Well, that's fine. The public are the public. They'll make their own choice. But if you have enough people challenging lies... challenging the mind. That's the only thing you can do. If people want to believe fantasy and lies, there's not much you can do about it, because whether you're a broadcaster or not, the reality is they're getting it online. I mean, very few people are, very few of the fantasists are getting their information from serious radio programs like this or from NBC or the BBC. That's not where they're getting their nonsense.
Well, to Vienna now, which is one of those cities which maintains a fleet of horse-drawn carriages for the benefit of tourists who would never consider riding in such a thing at home, but are suddenly anxious to do so once arriving somewhere foreign. The Fiaker horses, which have clopped the Austrian capital since the early 18th century, have also, it seems, taken a toll on the city's streets. Steel shoes are not good for asphalt. Now, however, Vienna's burghers are proposing a switch to plastic shoes, which will be less abrasive and quieter, and arguably more comfortable for the horses. I want some confessions from the table. Has anybody here ridden in a horse-drawn carriage?
Yes.
As a true
Austrian, I would usually, as a Viennese, we would never do things like that, because that's really a tourist thing to
Indeed.
Do. But I think once I took all my children when they were small and they really, really wanted to go. And I was sort of, you know, mortified, of course, going through Vienna, hoping nobody would see me. But it's actually, of course, quite nice if you... And I think if you are on a tourist trip, just go for it.
Now, William, did you ever have to sit in a horse-drawn carriage waving a funny hat and waving at crowds?
I did. It's the only time I've been in a horse-drawn carriage was at the state visit of King Abdullah.
Fantastic.
Dressed up in a morning suit and with my Saudis. And I've got some lovely photographs of me in a horse-drawn carriage. But I think the mall is used to it. But my wife would never let me do anything. I've often said, oh, let's go on a horse-drawn carriage when we've been somewhere. And I've never been allowed to do it. So.
See, I can only recall two occasions myself, both of which times there was legitimately no option. One was arriving very late at night in the railway station in Peshawar on the northwest frontier of Pakistan, and literally the only available transport at the railway station was a horse and cart.
It's sort of a necessity of life what you did.
Well, exactly. Weirdly, I was quite tired and may have been hallucinating, but the horse had been painted. It had sort of like swirly floral designs painted all over it. The only other time as well was in Amish County in Pennsylvania, where again there's a lack of options to get from one place to another. But we did want to broaden this out into a discussion of are there Tessa, first of all, because I understand that there is chat in Vienna about the propriety of continuing to allow these animals loose on the streets. Is it cruel for the horses? Is it all a bit old-fashioned? But this one aside, are there other old school traditions, not necessarily just from Austria, but anywhere else that you would defend?
Defend or attack?
Either's good.
You know,
really.
I usually attack the old fashioned one. You got the wrong guest here. But I mean, for example,
crazed Central European modernists.
Yeah. But for in Austria in particular, we have this, and it has caused a little bit of a stir lately, the idea of the Krampuslauf, which is, you know, St. Nicholas has here, I think there are little elves going along. But in Austria, there's a bad guy going along with the nice guy. So the nice guy brings the gifts, that's Santa, and the bad guy is sort of beating up the children. And there are actually people getting still beaten up.
People are coming out against the beating up of children.
Or not, because it's actually a tradition that happens every year. So
it's called the public school system, I think.
It's a public school system. It's very established here. In Austria, it's once a year on the 5th of December, and people regularly end up, you know, a few people get beaten up and end up in hospital. And you think, like, why are people allowing this? And then there's this argument that it's an old tradition. So In that case, I would say like
I looked this up, amazingly. Obviously, the fingers all point at Spain for bullfighting and running of the bulls and everything. But there's apparently a tradition in Belgium. It's called the Cat Festival, and it takes place in Ypres in May.
This can't go well for the cats.
No, no. Well, in fact, it's a great assembly of cat lovers, and it's a celebration of cats. But the original Cat Festival was they used to throw the cats from the top of the tower after they'd done their rat catching duties. Now they throw artificial cats, but they used to throw real ones.
That's an achievement.
It is a step forward. William, of course, you probably can't contribute much to this discussion because you come from Scotland, a country which famously has no bizarre arcane traditions that it clings doggedly to whatsoever. But of those that Scotland does still possess, are there any you're especially sentimental about and that you would defend?
Not really. Most of our traditions were invented in the 18th and 19th century. You know, all the bagpipes, the kilts, all of that stuff. It's all some modern invention, relatively modern invention.
Well, on that heretical note, Sir William Patey and Tessa Shishkovitz, thank you both for joining us. And finally, on today's Daily, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine a little over 2 years ago had an obvious near-term cause, i.e. the peculiar fantasy of President Vladimir Putin, Europe represented any kind of threat to him. But like pretty much everything that has ever happened, it was also a consequence of factors which had been brewing much longer. A new book by Michael Kimmage, Professor of History at the Catholic University of America and former State Department policy planner on Russia and Ukraine, places recent events in that broader context. The book is called Collisions, The Origins of the War in Ukraine and the New Global Instability. I spoke to Michael Kimmage earlier. I began by asking whether he had been among those surprised in February 2022 that Russia had actually gone through with it.
I was indeed surprised that Russia had gone through with it. I was surprised by the scale of the invasion, the massive scale of the invasion. The thing that was maybe not so surprising to me was that Russia had the motivation to do this kind of attack, because it is 8 years in the making, if not much longer. There is a trajectory that takes us to this point, and it's not as if Russia arrived there in January of 2022. I mean, there's a long continuum of events, but the radicalism in the scale of the event I thought was completely shocking.
But nonetheless, to go to that point you were making about something much more eternal than the last 2 years, when you think back on the post-World War II decades, has it just been one long misjudgment of Russia by Western Europe, perhaps especially after the apparent victory of the Cold War? There was this idea, which persisted in some circles up until 2 years ago, that Russia could become just another European country.
Well, I think there is persistent misjudgment. There's a refusal to accept and understand the way in which Russia relates to its Western border, its border with Europe, that it's not just Stalin who sought a buffer zone. It's, in effect, almost every Russian leader going back before the Soviet Union, and that would include Yeltsin and Putin alike. And so that was, I think, not given its due. On the other hand, as a historian of these events, I do have a lot of empathy for the people making these judgments in real time, because there were the 4 years when Dmitry Medvedev was president of Russia. This is 2008 to 2012. And it did seem as if Russia was heading in quite a different direction then toward integration with Europe. And even if you go back to the first few years of Putin's presidency, and of course, he may have been dishonest about all of this, but he spoke about Russia joining NATO. You know, it's the first head of state to call after September 11th in the United States is Vladimir Putin. And the United States and Russia and countries of Europe and Russia conducted a lot of business together, you know, really all the way up until 2022. So, yes, there's been a misunderstanding of the way that Russia relates to Europe, a kind of fundamental mistake. But Russia itself has changed and, in a sense, radicalized over time. And that's made it a country that's especially difficult to read.
But that misunderstanding obviously goes both ways. And it's a question I've asked a lot of people who've written about this from both sides. That attitude you mention of Russia's attitude towards its western border, you're quite right to point out that Russia has, of course, faced many threats from that direction in its history. And it has suffered excruciating agonies because of threats from that direction across its history. But does Russia really not believe that that threat is over? Because there is nobody in Western Europe anymore who has the least bit of interest of acquiring a centimetre of Russian territory, and it is frankly unimaginable that they ever would.
To be sure, I think that it's a very useful exercise to look at Western mistakes vis-a-vis Russia after 1991, and there are many of them. But it's also the case, and this may be the crux of the story, that Russia never had such a peaceful Europe to deal with as the Europe that it faced after 1991. And it missed a real opportunity to build bridges of partnership and understanding in those years. I mean, there were times when it inched in that direction, but basically Russia missed that chance. Is it Russia that missed the chance, or is it Putin that missed the chance? I do get the sense that the Russian population basically supports Putin now, supported Putin in the past, but had no desire to push Russia into the 2022 war that it's mounted against Ukraine. Annexation of Crimea was relatively popular, but I think there are ways in which Putin approaches all of these problems with a degree of paranoia, concern, worry, egotism, national egotism, that's in fact out of sync with the Russian population. So Russia has a leader who's as disposed to create problems with Europe and the United States as possible. And that's in part the story of the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. It is a matter of leadership. It's not in the Russian DNA. It's a set of choices in the Russian leadership, and they have blown past a very peaceful Europe. That's absolutely the case, I would say.
Does that schism that has developed now, though, between Russia and Europe, does that strike you as something that Europe needs to think about as if it is going to be at least as long-lasting a fixture as the Iron Curtain ever was? There's a line in the conclusion, and I promise listeners this is absolutely not a spoiler. The whole book is worth reading. But you write, and I quote, "Having opted for war, Putin has secured Russia's lasting non-Western orientation." Do you think that doesn't even change, even if there is a change of regime, perhaps as a consequence of some bizarre eruption like the one we nearly saw with the abortive Yevgeny Prigozhin rebellion?
Well, there is the possibility that Russia could shift in a different direction. It's a hardened dictatorship at this point, and dictatorships can break precipitously and change course dramatically. It's a possibility, but I would put it at 1 in 100. That Russia would break in a direction that would take it out of this mode of confrontation with the West. I think that the very understandable Western conditions for peace in Ukraine are full acceptance of Ukrainian sovereignty, war crimes tribunals, and reparations on the Russian side. I just can't envision any Russian leader meeting those conditions and still surviving as a political figure in Russia. I think that Putin has been very, in a sense, intelligent from his side and calculating about making Russians complicit with the war. You know, it's hard for a country to deal with that kind of complicity in a sort of comprehensive fashion. It's much easier in some ways to carry on with this mode of confrontation and to keep these narratives of Russian greatness and Russian embattlement front and center. I think it's very, very difficult. And then finally, I think it's the structures that Putin himself has built up. What are the functioning institutions in Russia? It's the military, it's the security services, it's the office of the Kremlin. It's basically a very militarized version of Russian politics that is Russian politics at this point, and that would have to be eviscerated or overcome to take Russia out of the war or take it out of its warlike posture, and I just don't see any of that happening. So yes, I think Europe has to reckon with, to take a phrase from the book, a generational conflict with Russia, and you know, not to overdo it, not to exaggerate, not to overdramatize, but to be very sober about the stakes and the longevity of this conflict.
Just as a final thought then, and looking at how Europe's miscalculations may have got us to this point, did Europe, especially Western Europe, and especially after World War II, and then even more especially after about 1991, start to settle into the idea that war in Europe was now an anomaly? It was something that didn't happen here anymore, which of course any reading of European history should persuade anybody was a monstrous fallacy, war being what Europeans have pretty much always done.
Well, I couldn't agree with that more. As you know from the book, it's full of citations and quotations from Thucydides, in part because he's good to quote, but in part because this is the first or among the first works of European history, and it's the story of a war. So I'm trying to sort of underscore your point through that method. The thing that's difficult to understand about Europe, and I think the United States made precisely the same mistake after 1991, is the optimism. You know, optimism is a nice thing, but you can overdo it. And the optimism around European integration is really almost unfathomable in retrospect. And of course, it's integral to the story because Ukraine undergoes a revolution in 2013, 2014 because of a project about integrating Ukraine into Europe. And it kind of goes awry in a sense, and it results in a leadership change, and that then brings Russia very aggressively into the picture. But just the optimism. Of course, it was a nice idea, and I think it will happen at a certain point that Ukraine will really be integrated into Europe. That will be one of the results of the war. But that this was done with such a almost naive spirit before, with no military component, without thinking through questions of balance of forces, line of contact between Europe and Russia, all of this is hard to understand in retrospect. And it's been a very bitter awakening. I wouldn't just say for Europeans, it's been a very bitter awakening for all of us to see Europe, which has gone such a distance to overcoming the, you know, Anglo-German disputes and the Franco-German disputes and the German-Polish disputes are all things of the past. And yet we're sort of back in this stage of regional war. So it's certainly very sad to observe, but it's a lesson about how and in which way we should be intellectually prepared for the future.
That was Michael Kimmage, and his fine new book, Collisions, is available now. That is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Tessa Shishkovitz and Sir William Patey. The show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Flynn Simons. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.